I told him you were earning a living.
That's right. Unlike most elite research universities around the land, UVA has this archaic and quaint tradition. It's called teaching. I guess each year I'm here, I become more of a who and get a little more engaged in my teaching. So the class I was teaching is called Viewing America 1945 to the Present. And I take the last word in that title seriously. So I actually made it through September 11th, 2001 today. I really didn't want to give that moment short shrift, so I apologize.
To give you a breath, if you have a Monday and Wednesday class, nobody comes on Wednesday. So for years you show up and plan to meet with them, but there are no students. And suddenly it dawns on you that they're simply making a quick getaway, and maybe yours are different.
I didn't say we had a tradition of learning, Ken. I just said we had a tradition of teaching. Okay, well, thank you for hanging in. I apologize for being late. The upside is I'm warmed up. In 1937, during America's deepest and most prolonged economic crisis, and in the midst of disturbing trends towards dictatorship abroad, a team of America's leading social scientists and public officials issued a report titled Administrative Management in the Government of the United States. The Brownlow Committee report, named for the committee's chair, Lewis Brownlow, began by considering the purposes of executive reorganization. The goals of reorganization drew upon cherished values with deep roots in American history: economy, efficiency, the application of better business methods, and fiscal controls. In the end, however, the committee concluded that there was but one grand purpose animating reform, quote, to make democracy work today in our national government, end quote. Making democracy work has indeed been the overarching goal of efforts to adapt the nation's administrative capacity to changing political, social, and technological developments ever since the first congressional foray into reorganization. Today, I'd like to consider the recently passed legislation to create a Homeland Security Department in the context of other major executive reorganizations over the past 100 years. And I want to personally thank Ken for arranging for the president to sign the bill on the day of my talk. I had always heard about Mr. Thompson's influence, but now I'm convinced. As you know, by any standards, this reorganization is a large one. It will consolidate almost 170,000 employees who currently work in 22 federal agencies. It will be the third largest employer within the federal government, behind Defense and Veterans Affairs. Although the final budget has not yet been settled, it will likely be over $35 billion a year. The key mission of the new department, the key missions entail coordinating intelligence and warning about terrorist attacks through a new information and analysis unit, protecting border and transportation security, protecting critical infrastructure and key assets from terrorist attack, defending against catastrophic threats from chemical, biological, radiological, and nuclear weapons, and emergency preparedness and response. Major reorganizations have been achieved through three distinct mechanisms over the past century. The most straightforward and the most common mechanism is enabling legislation. This is the course that both the chair of the Senate Committee on Government Operations, Senator Joseph Lieberman, and President Bush chose when they introduced legislation that would create a cabinet-level department responsible for homeland security. This produced a bill that President Bush will sign into law today. Enabling legislation has been the mechanism of choice when creating most new departments in the 20th century, or when reforming personnel and purchasing procedures. Granting broad emergency powers to the president is the mechanism that has been used the least. During World War I, World War II, and the Korean War, Congress passed legislation that gave presidents broad discretion in reorganizing the executive branch of government. Only once did peacetime legislation delegate the president the kind of emergency discretion contained in the Overman Act and the War Powers Act of 1941. The amendments to the Economy Act of 1932, which were passed in March of 1933, proclaimed that, quote, serious emergency exists by reason of general economic depression, end quote. To free the president's hand for action to remedy the situation, the amendments granted the president permission to conduct broad-ranging reorganization in the executive branch without obtaining congressional permission. The third mechanism for effecting broad-scale executive reorganization is legislation granting presidents sweeping authority to submit plans or executive orders to Congress in order to reorganize the executive branch, but subjecting such plans to congressional scrutiny through legislative veto. Although he is often associated with conservative opposition to the expansion of the federal government, it was Herbert Hoover, of all people, who advocated for and eventually obtained the crucial device that made such broad grants of discretion possible during peacetime. Hoover was the first president to receive congressional permission to reorganize, subject to congressional veto. This power was embodied in the Economy Act of 1932. It was Hoover again, now in the role of private citizen, who helped institutionalize this device when he chaired the first Hoover Commission after World War II. Presidents submitted over 100 reorganization plans to Congress between 1949 and 1980, and the vast majority were implemented. The scope of the reform contained in these plans ranged from housekeeping matters to innovations of seminal importance. President Jimmy Carter's Reorganization Plan No. 1 of 1979 is a good example of the housekeeping. It set up a federal inspector for the Alaska pipeline, not really a monumental change in the structure of the federal government. On the other hand, the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare was created in 1953 via Reorganization Plan, and President John F. Kennedy proposed the creation of a new Department of Urban Affairs and Housing via Reorganization Plan, a proposal that was vetoed by Congress. President Richard Nixon used his reorganization authority to propose major changes in the executive office of the president when he transformed the Bureau of the Budget into the Office of Management and Budget and formed the Environmental Protection Agency. But by the early 1980s, congressional concerns about an imperial presidency and the Supreme Court's ruling that the congressional veto was unconstitutional crippled the use of broad legislative grants of discretionary authority to the president for the purpose of reorganization. During the 20th century, the initiative for executive reorganization shifted from Congress to the president. The objectives of reform evolved as well. Early reforms were directed primarily at reducing the costs of government through elimination of duplication and waste. For the middle third of the century, executive reorganization expanded broadly the definition of efficiency, focusing on effective management and granting the president greater political control in order to achieve increasingly ambitious public policy objectives. The New Deal's ideals could not be achieved if its programs were not efficiently managed and coordinated by a president who had the staff and skills at his disposal and the management hierarchy in place to make good on its policy promises. The United States would not be secure in its twilight battle with the Soviet Union if the president could not count on well-coordinated and unified national security establishment to carry out his defense policies. The great society would be mediocre at best without effective management of its wide-ranging programs. Advocates of this approach, which centralized control in the executive office of the president, also argued that these innovations would strengthen democracy since Congress was incapable of coordinating policy effectively. Americans could hold the only office that they all voted for, the presidency, accountable for delivering upon political and public policy promises. In the aftermath of Vietnam and Watergate, however, the thrust of executive reorganization shifted once again. To be sure, there was a return to calls for economy and savings, given the huge budget deficits that had begun to mount. This earliest objective of reorganization, that of cost savings, had never been entirely forsaken, as the second Hoover Commission demonstrates and Ronald Reagan's Grace Commission confirmed. But there was a new element in many of these reorganizations as well, a call for, quote, compassion in government, as Jimmy Carter put it, or customer satisfaction, to use the market-oriented language of reform that pervaded Bill Clinton and Al Gore's efforts to reinvent government. Having centralized authority, many Americans were now concerned with making it responsive to individual needs. Although Carter and Clinton never used the language of George Wallace, who made a political career out of threatening pointy-headed bureaucrats, they both responded to a shift in public attitudes, business practice, and public administration theory that favored decentralization and empowerment of both clients and middle-level decision makers. As David Osborne and Ted Gabler, authors of Reinventing Government, put it, quote, in today's world, things simply work better if those working in public organizations, schools, public housing developments, parks, training programs, have the authority to make many of their own decisions, end quote. Any summary of the history of executive reorganizations must conclude that large-scale reorganizations are not easy to enact. If they are needed every so often to make democracy work, the past record of legislative failure underscores just how delicate a mechanism democracy really is. Executive reorganization in 20th century America has entailed an uncomfortable mixture of public administration ideals, policy preferences, and brass knuckles politics, particularly when powerful interest groups, congressional oversight committees, or agency turf have been threatened by the reform. Despite the heightened sense of crisis created by the terrorist attack of 9/11, proposals to reorganize the executive branch of the federal government to create a Department of Homeland Security were not immune to the cross-cutting pressures that have framed most debates about reorganization over the course of the last century. Even partisan ties did not protect the plans from the centrifugal forces that reorganization proposals often run into, as George Bush discovered when the House of Representatives distributed his Homeland Security proposal to a host of committees in mid-July. Although the votes were non-binding, they signaled potential rough sailing for Bush's vision. The House Judiciary Committee voted to make a number of changes in the president's plan, rebuffing his proposal to transfer the Federal Emergency Management Agency to the new department, for instance. The Armed Services Committee on the same day rejected the transfer of Loris Livermore, National Laboratories Intelligence Analyst, to the new department. As the chair of House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee, Don Young, put it, quote, we're not happy. And if they go too far, they're going to have a revolution on their hands, end quote. These are Republicans talking to the Republican president in a time of ostensible crisis. Young tried to block transfer of another proposed piece of the Homeland Security puzzle, the Coast Guard. The battles that were fought this summer, sometimes within partisan ranks, are characteristic of the role that congressional turf and its connection to special interests play in executive reform. To Young, for instance, protecting the Coast Guard's responsibilities to his Alaskan constituents' maritime needs trumped more distant concerns about terrorist attacks. The Brownlow Committee's proposal ran into the same kind of opposition from partisan allies of Roosevelt in the Congress and allies of Roosevelt's in his own cabinet. Arrayed functionally across the public policy landscape, interest groups offered powerful resistance to Roosevelt's plan, fearing that hard-fought access, clout, or merely routine familiarity might be lost if the administrative deck was reshuffled. Many of the very interest groups that had benefited from the New Deal and that could usually be counted upon for support feared that reorganization would harm the benefits they enjoyed under the current system. Groups were sympathetic to the issue of reorganization, but were only willing to support reform if they were exempted themselves from the change. Groups that did not oppose reform generally remained neutral on the matter. Bureaucrats and members of congressional committees also sought exemption for their turf as they feared the loss of political clout. All three players in the relationship that political scientists call iron triangles feared the loss of the networks and relationships they had built up under existing executive mechanisms. The scope of the Brownlow Committee's reform, and perhaps even more significantly, the underlying philosophy of presidential control, fusing policy objectives and administrative responsibility, prompted interest groups and their public patrons to circle the wagons as they squared off with the president. For example, Roosevelt's proposal to create a Department of Conservation met with resistance from the Department of Interior and the Department of Agriculture, as well as from interested parties such as forestry associations, lumber groups, grazing interests, farm groups, and conservation groups. The scene was familiar over in the Department of Labor, where Secretary Frances Perkins proved tenacious in her defense of the existing administrative arrangements. When Harold Smith, director of the Budget Bureau, informed the Secretary of plans to relocate several bureaus currently in labor, Perkins lectured Smith for an hour on the historical and philosophical conception of the Labor Department. The Secretary's position might have been influenced by her interest group patron, organized labor. The American Federation of Labor sought to protect the employment service housed within the Department of Labor, as AFL President William Green informed Roosevelt. Quote, "We wish that we might have a larger labor department. We certainly protest against its curtailment and any reduction in its standing and influence," end quote. Partisan differences, of course, also loomed large. During the New Deal era, each party sought to connect executive reform with the most potent symbols available. For FDR and his Democratic supporters, the Brownlow Committee's reforms represented a chance for the federal government to make good on its promises. It sought to empower the president to deliver those social goods that the New Deal legislative coalition worked hard to secure. Republicans turned the symbolism around, stressing that the executive reforms were a power grab that mirrored Roosevelt's court-packing scheme. Together, these New Deal experiments would destroy the traditional balance the three branches of government enjoyed and pave the way for an autocratic executive, the Republicans argued. The struggle for partisan advantage almost derailed the Homeland Security executive reorganization as well. There was relatively little dispute over the basic structure of the new agency. Democratic Senator Joseph Lieberman introduced legislation first. The president weighed in with his own bill in the House that did not look all that different. But differences soon emerged over the details. These details, in turn, resonated symbolically with millions of voters. The Republican draft, citing the need for managerial flexibility in an uncertain and rapidly changing security environment, sought to waive a number of civil service rules in the new agency that would grant managers far more flexibility to hire, fire, promote, and sanction employees. For Republican Senator Phil Graham, workers protecting the nation in the new Department of Homeland Security should be no different than the Marines. They should be sent where they are needed and go where they are told to go, as Graham put it. Graham contrasted this flexibility with the existing rules for Border Patrol agents, who are subject to an elaborate transfer process, or civil service workers, who are difficult to fire or demote. To Senator Lieberman, these changes were a minor matter that the administration should address once the crucial legislation was passed. As Lieberman put it in August, as the legislation bogged down in partisan squabbling, quote, "I wonder whether someone in the White House may have convinced the president to make this a larger issue because of some partisan ideological agenda that has no place here," end quote. but two could play at this game of partisan name-calling. And it appears that the Republicans got the last word in as the November election loomed. Correctly perceiving that the issue exposed a core Democratic constituency, public sector unions, that did not necessarily appeal to all Democrats, not to mention independents and the electorate at large, Republicans charged that it was Democrats who were playing fast and loose with the nation's homeland security in order to please a special interest, those public service unions. As Homeland Security Director Tom Ridge put it, quote, "At this challenging time, we believe that it is not logical, especially in this time of war, for the president to have this critical national security authority for each of the 14 existing cabinet departments, but to have that authority effectively stripped from him when it comes to the department created for the very purpose of protecting the homeland," end quote. The Republicans got the better of this argument politically. For the same reason that sweeping Homeland Security legislation will be signed into law today. In a word, that reason is crisis. There is a stark contrast between executive reorganizations initiated in response to crises and those initiated during periods of relative tranquility. Crisis reorganizations have a much better chance of passing. And this, more than any other factor, explains why President Bush has a Homeland Security bill to sign today. But both the Bush administration and Congress have danced around the real crisis question. Rhetorically, both branches have stressed the serious nature of the threat from terrorism. The President's Office of Homeland Security, for instance, warned a few months ago that, quote, "unless we act to prevent it, a new wave of terrorism potentially involving the world's most destructive weapons looms in America's future," end quote. Labeling the challenge as, quote, "formidable as any ever faced by our nation," end quote, President Bush demanded speedy action on legislation to create a new department and justified the suspension of civil service protections as crucial to averting further catastrophic attacks. The speed with which the president asked Congress to act and the administrative discretion that the proposal requested for the new department fits squarely within the historical tradition of emergency powers requested during times of crisis. Four times over the course of the past century, Congress granted these powers to the president. The Overman Act, passed during World War I, the amendments to the Economy Act, passed in 1933, the War Powers Act of 1941, passed days after Pearl Harbor, and the Defense Production Act of 1950, passed in response to the Korean War. Yet President Bush did not request emergency powers. In fact, the historical analogy that the president is most fond of deploying is the National Security Act of 1947. Bush explicitly cited the National Security Act when he transmitted his legislative proposal to Congress. As he put it, quote, "This reorganization of America's national security establishment was crucial to overcoming the enormous threat we faced in the Cold War and holds important lessons for our approach to the terrorist threat we face today," end quote. The saga of military unification and the evolution of the national security state, however, is far more representative of non-crisis reorganization. Little improvement in defense management was actually achieved by the initial 1947 Act. Indeed, the first Secretary of Defense, James V. Forrestal, once called his office a cemetery for dead cats. Go figure. With the exception of a few changes implemented during the Korean War, none of these reforms were achieved using the president's emergency powers. Like most non-crisis reforms, it took decades to enact fully and was the subject of countless political and policy debates. The Defense Reorganization Act, commonly known as the Goldwater-Nichols Act, was the crucial turning point in the unification story. That act was passed nearly 40 years after the initial unification legislation. Congress, too, has played a double game on the question of crisis. It has moved with remarkable speed, suggesting that it considers this set of reforms to be urgent. To do so, the House set up a special committee to rein in special pleading interest groups adversely affected by the reorganization. It was through this process, for instance, that the House restored the Federal Emergency Management Administration to the Department of Homeland Security and retained, in spite of Representative Young's pleas, the Coast Guard. The Senate, though more subject to procedural delays, moved quickly as well. In fact, the pace of both houses was unprecedented for non-crisis reorganizations. Both houses moved even faster than the Woodrow Wilson administration, and Congress moved to pass the Overman Act, granting the president emergency powers during World War I. But the real test lies ahead in the implementation process. When it comes to major executive reorganization, effectiveness ultimately turns on implementation. In the case of Homeland Security, four challenges lie ahead. First, the ability of Congress to reorganize itself in order effectively to oversee the new department. We've reorganized the executive branch. We now have to see whether Congress can reorganize itself. Second, continuing administrative discretion within the new department. Third, the resources to accomplish the mission that Homeland Security is tasked with. And fourth, the challenge of intergovernmental relations. Congress will have the final say on all of these crucial tests. And in the final analysis, congressional response is likely to turn on the perceived severity of the ongoing threat from terrorism. In other words, a sense of crisis explains how such a massive reorganization was accomplished in such a short time. The degree to which the legislation achieves its ends will turn on whether that sense of crisis persists. Let me conclude by saying a brief word on each of the four challenges faced in implementing the new department. Congressional reorganization first. According to the Bush administration, 13 full committees in each House and 88 committees and subcommittees overall share responsibility for Homeland Security. Consolidating executive responsibility will accomplish little if Congress fails to coordinate its oversight of the Homeland Security mission. Adapting the committee structure in Congress to reflect executive branch reorganization is crucial to the success of executive reform. The historical record is filled with examples of executive reorganization that is enacted legislatively, but that fails to gain traction because congressional oversight and appropriations responsibility is left unchanged. FEMA is a good example. Now held up as a model agency, it's easy to forget that in its early years, FEMA didn't just respond to disaster, it was a disaster. One of the principal reasons for this is that FEMA originally reported to 20 different committees in the Congress. It was only after FEMA was reorganized itself and the congressional oversight responsibility for FEMA was reorganized that FEMA began to function more effectively. Because the agencies that will comprise the new Department of Homeland Security currently report to dozens of committees and subcommittees, Congress faces a significant challenge of its own if it is to avoid pulling the new department in competing directions. Second challenge, administrative discretion. The scope and nature of the terrorist threat is likely to evolve dramatically over the next decade. We can anticipate that terrorists will adapt their strategy as they seek to defeat our response to it. For this reason, it is essential that the new department be given ample administrative discretion to evolve as well. This is particularly important because the department is expected to play a crucial preemptive role, detecting and anticipating attacks. Granting administrative discretion, however, erodes legislative control, and as we have seen in the case of civil service work rules, is highly contested. The dust-up over work rules is small potatoes compared to some of the huge constitutional issues concerning the trade-off between security and civil liberties that are likely to be broached by the new department. Third challenge, resources. Many of the battles fought over consolidating the national defense establishment from the late 1940s up till today have turned on how many resources have been allocated to this function. Some of the new department's more ambitious programs have already been delayed. Some of the new Department of Homeland Security's more ambitious programs have already been delayed as a result of the budget deadlock in Washington today. The budget deadlock has frozen initiatives ranging from increased federal aid to first responders to programs to inspect cargo containers overseas. Fourth, intergovernmental relations. As the example of federal aid to first responders suggests, intergovernmental relations will be crucial to the success of the new department. In fact, no executive reorganization has ever carried greater implications for relations between the federal government and state and local governments. This presents a major challenge because executive reorganization generally disrupts relationships with state and local governments during the implementation phase. One promising sign is that FEMA was included in the new department. It is well positioned to create a foundation for long-term connection of national homeland security objectives with state and local jurisdictions, building on FEMA's now well-established network. As in the case with the balance between executive and congressional power and the constitutional trade-off between security and civil liberties, however, the degree to which the federal government dictates to the states will surely be a source of tension. With the long-standing pattern of crisis and non-crisis reorganizations in mind, and with the battle for enabling legislation behind us, the President and Congress have the opportunity to break the historical mold by forging a compromise on their institutional prerogatives. It will take courage and the shared conviction that the threat this nation faces is real and likely to grow. And it will take political leadership. The potential is there, however, for a compromise that does grant the department an extraordinary degree of flexibility in return for guarantees that privileges will be exercised on a temporary basis and only for the duration of the crisis. The crisis may well last longer than any the nation has ever faced. Nonetheless, acknowledging that it is a crisis and that the executive branch does require greater flexibility during times of crisis may well stave off the need for the president to ask for those emergency powers, which would most likely be granted and undoubtedly would hand the president far more sweeping authority than even the most capacious interpretations of those implied in the current Department of Homeland Security legislation. Failure to reach such an agreement presents a conundrum that will most likely be resolved by the, quote, bad guys, as President Bush likes to call them. The more time that passes without terrorist incident, the stronger the pressure to treat this reorganization like the dozens of others that have inched their way towards completion over decades. Yet if the threat is credible, and if it is likely to increase over time, as many believe, squandering any time or assets in the race to detect, prevent, and respond to terrorist attack may prove costly indeed. Can our political leaders muster the courage to work cooperatively in the gray areas between crisis and business as usual? Or must we once again leave it to our enemies to define the severity of the threat?
Who'd like to begin the discussion?
Would you wait for the mic just a minute? Just for the benefit of the people in the other room, would you wait for the mic, please?
I wonder, the absence of the FBI and the CIA in the Homeland Security arrangement, do you think that they will cooperate closely with the new committees?
Well, do you mean the new department?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, speaking as a historian, looking at the century of executive reorganization that I've looked at, the answer clearly is no. There is a long history of bureaucratic turf battles that are faced by any new agency. And probably the National Security Act of 47 is a great example. It was intended to unify the armed services, and as we know, that hardly happened right away. The reason it didn't were these kind of bureaucratic turf rivalries for resources. Having said that, I do think it's crucial that we begin facing the problems that we inevitably are going to face in terms of friction between different organizations. The president has chosen what in its totality actually is a fairly decentralized approach to this. He's left the FBI intact. He's left major responsibility with the CIA. My guess is, although it's not talked about right now, that the job that Tom Ridge holds right now, Director of Homeland Security, and that's the Homeland Security Council, perhaps. It's an equivalent to the National Security Council. It's not a large department. It's a coordinating mechanism. My guess is that that council, that coordinating role that Ridge is in actually right now, is going to emerge as crucially important 10 years from now. The reason I say that, again speaking as a historian, is that the National Security Council, when it was first created, was viewed as something between an afterthought, a joke, and a slap in the face to Henry Truman because he didn't know anything about foreign policy. It really had very little clout at the time it was formed. It didn't have a strong director, but by the 1960s, it began to emerge as a real force in foreign policy, and certainly under National Security Director Henry Kissinger, it was, at times, the only game in town. So one of the things that looking at executive reorganization over time has really taught me is watch out for those little units that don't receive much attention. As I look at the national, at the Homeland Security front, it looks quite decentralized to me with the CIA, with the FBI. Somebody is going to need to bring those all together. And my guess is somewhere down the road, we are going to have the equivalent of a national security advisor for Homeland Security emerge. But you know, I'm an historian, and I get paid the big bucks for reading archives, not for predicting the future. So,
next question.
Yes.
Don't you think that the success of this depends upon the strength of the war metaphor that we've been operating on for the last 14 months? And if we don't have anything approaching what happened on 9/11, don't you think the support for such reorganization, as you've mentioned, the possible downfalls, will certainly become more apparent? In other words, there'll be less pressure to conform and bring about the accords.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think if there are no more terrorist incidents, I think that if we do conduct a shooting war against Iraq, I think both of those may have a tendency to take some of the pressure off both the president and Congress to compromise on these huge issues of constitutional balance of power. And I think the normal set of pressures that exist in Washington will reassert themselves. And before we know it, the Coast Guard will be back protecting Representative Young's constituents and not wasting its time, from his perspective, on fighting terrorism.
Next question. Mr. Holo.
The heaviest and most immediate burden of any catastrophic event will fall on the state and local first responders. You mentioned the importance of intergovernmental affairs. They need centralization and reconciliation of standards and training, radio frequencies, whatever, more than federal government does. Does the new department have a specific component that will provide the forum for such work? That will be fantastic for the thousands of departments and things.
Yeah, well, to answer your question, what's the rental car commercial? Not exactly. I think there was a rental car commercial that turned on. Well, not exactly. And what the new department has is a mission to do what you said. It has the mission to respond to catastrophic attack. That is clear. And that's where most of its interaction with state and local government is going to come. More importantly to me than the mission, which after all is just words, is the experience of the Federal Emergency Management Administration. That's why folding FEMA into this department, I think, is so crucial. When I looked at the history of reorganization, one of the huge reorganizations I looked at was the Environmental Protection Administration. And the thing that they had the most trouble with in their first 10 years was intergovernmental relations. I mean, it's easy to forget that some of the functions that EPA, quote, created were functions that had been carried out by states and local governments. States and local governments were not keen, necessarily, on having the federal government take these over. What FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Administration, gives the Department of Homeland Security is an established federal entity that already has connections to and relations to states and localities in the area of crisis response. Now, to be sure, these are very different kinds of crises than Hurricane Andrew. Nonetheless, those existing linkages are there. And to me, those are the kinds of linkages that are hardest to develop, even harder than that between federal agency and federal agency. The relationships that the Public Health Service, for instance, built up with state and local entities took decades to establish, and by the 50s and the 60s were really pretty effective. The relationship that the Office of Education built up within HEW to state and local school boards and school commissions was crucial and took decades to build up. So I do think the good news is that FEMA will give this department more of a leg up than most new departments have when they set out to establish relations with state and local governments. That's a really good question.
General McInnes?
You've addressed the intergovernmental. What's foreseen in terms of interaction with non-governmental organizations? It seems to me like there's a huge opportunity there as well.
I think there's an opportunity this will alienate half the audience, but if you read the Washington Post, there's a risk as well. Clearly, the department's mission to shore up and maintain critical infrastructure is directed at creating relationships with the private sector, with the non-governmental sector, and that's where a lot of the potential threat lies. That's where a lot of the potential information about threats may come through. And that is seen by this department, I think, as being one of its core missions, establishing relations with the private and voluntary sector. The Post story that I'm referring to is the saga of the FBI's quick and dirty efforts to establish those kinds of relationships with the private sector, particularly the corporate sector, in the immediate wake of 9/11. And what the FBI did was circulate a list of potential or suspected terrorists. That list has gone through iteration and iteration, but has not been necessarily updated where it was first received. And there are now, according to the Post, literally dozens, if not hundreds, of out-of-date lists being used for all kinds of reasons by corporate America. So you understand, I mean, the linkage between heightened security, heightened preparedness, prevention, and possible abuse of civil liberties simply can't be gotten around. And the danger of these decentralized relationships is you now not only have to worry about controlling information within the federal government, you have to worry about controlling privileged information in entities that are not public at all. It's going to be a huge challenge and a very delicate balance to maintain. And I think that balance, to get back to the point over here, ultimately, unfortunately, it is going to swing wildly back and forth based on the perceived sense of threat and crisis.
Victor Yonke first, and then Victor, you.
In this function, will this sort part of the government have to first answer to the executive branch or the Defense Department?
To the president, they don't report to the Defense Department. Is that your question?
Why wouldn't they report to the Defense Department then?
Because they don't. It's a separate cabinet level department, any more than Health and Human Services reports to the Defense Department. I'm sure the Defense Department wishes that they reported to the Defense Department, but they will not under the existing structure.
Okay.
Sure.
Just a comment first, colleague Bellow. I'm very happy to hear that since I retired, you fellows have paid so much money over there in the History Department. It's not what I read in the newspaper. But I've learned that what one reads
in the newspaper. They gave me your lunch allowance.
What one reads in the newspaper is hardly an accurate guide to what's going on in our world. I want to ask you a question, Brian, about what you said is the source, the driving force that led to this act, and then ask you to reflect on some of the larger implications. Crisis. This came about because of a sense of crisis. I have no idea what people think the sense of the real crisis is. There seems to be an assumption that we all know what the crisis is. We were abroad in September of 9/11, all of September of a year ago, and horrified though we were, and we were really horrified because our son used to work in the World Trade Center, and some people didn't know whether he was still there, so it was pretty scary. And we shared all of the sense that one had to mobilize to find these, well, I won't use that noun, find these people who had done these things to us. At the same time, we understood that this pinpointed a deep and ongoing crisis in world history, which was America's sense of innocence and its sense of invincibility, and its total lack of awareness that somehow it was responsible, not directly responsible, but somehow our place in the world had led to a crisis so that so many people hated us. So that eventually Nelson Mandela, the greatest hero in my judgment of political leadership in this last century, would say America is a threat to world power. So my question, would you reflect for a little bit on the nature of the crisis facing this country that all those people who passed this bill felt? And a subpart of that is the passage of the Homeland Security Act, the notion, the assumption about what it's aiming at, likely to include, to encourage people to think that we do live in a crisis age in which we play a part? It's not as simple. that there's this whole world of people out there to get us, and all we have to do is pull out our six shooters and kill them all, and we'll be okay.
Yeah. Well, if you're asking me to speculate on what was in the minds of the people who passed the legislation, I guess I can speculate.
No,
experts also know when to punt. I would speculate that those who passed the legislation have a very different perspective on this, on what the sense of crisis is than you do. And you used two different words. I think I know which one you mean. In one iteration, you said America is at least in part responsible for the anger and for the reaction. In another iteration, you said we are a part of. Switching to my own views, I think we are a part of a world that I think that our vision of the world has provoked a response, a very hateful response towards the United States. And I don't deny that our vision of the world is part of that, part of what caused that. I would part ways with you in terms of saying that we are responsible for these actions. I think that what we're facing is two very different visions of the world. One is a liberal capitalist vision of globalization and internationalization, freedom of discourse, trade, a global economy, and I think the United States increasingly is buying into that and is responsible for that. I think that inevitably is going to provoke very strong responses. It really disrupts power relations around the world, and that's what happens when you disrupt power relations. But I don't view the United States as responsible for creating this problem. I mean,
I don't mean that direct. I think more in the sense of helping to confront. Never mind. You go ahead and explore some more. You know what I mean.
Yeah. So, now, you know, are there things we can do along with securing the homeland, a phrase that I find very troubling, but nonetheless subscribe to and support, in spite of the phrase. Are there things we can do along in our foreign policy along with that? Absolutely. Are there things that we can do in our relations with the rest of the world? Absolutely. However, I would be the last person in the world to suggest that we should wait and see how changes in those policies that might improve relations turn out before we take steps to secure the homeland. I could add against the bad guys if you really want me to sound like...
Maximize or minimize our chances.
Pardon?
Exactly. Maximize or minimize our chances of seeing this global picture as you've described.
Oh, I think it reduces our chances. I think that the act definitely will make millions of Americans feel that this is it. We're threatened. We're going to take steps to secure ourselves against that threat. And the only thing I can say is that I don't think many of those Americans would be responsive to notions that we can do something about the threat through constructive steps anyway.
Well, we've come to our normal adjournment time, and we thank you all for coming. Thank Brian for
welcome.